Ecclesiastes and really enjoying that class. Tonight I wanted to go back. I wasn't here for the beginning of the study of the book of Ecclesiastes, but I just wanted to bring out one of my favorite things about the book as I kind of zoom out and look big picture at some of the things that it seems are trying to be stressed. There's a couple of messages that the book teaches us that I feel like are very important for us to be reminded of, and I want to touch on one of those tonight. For the purposes of this lesson, in just general study, I'm going to use the name Solomon a lot tonight. Traditionally, Solomon is attributed as the author of the book of Ecclesiastes, and we're going to assume that as we go through our lesson tonight. In this life, there are a lot of things that we do. There are a lot of efforts that we engage in, a lot of time and a lot of energy that we put into trying to find meaning. We hear so often, whether it be on TV or different people saying that they're going to go and try to find themselves, go off and spend so much time at a specific place, and they're going to put their efforts into trying to discover who they are and what their purposes are. But it's interesting because the Bible tells us exactly what that is, what our very purpose is, what our meaning is. Our Creator Himself gives us through His holy, inspired Word what it is that His expectations are for each one of us. And so tonight, just for a few minutes, let's just examine this search for meaning that Solomon himself engages in as we read through the book of Ecclesiastes. Why does anybody search for anything, though? Before we begin, why is it that we search for things? Well, we search for things because we trust and have confidence that they exist. And so in one search for meaning, they are acknowledging, by implication, that meaning is somewhere to be found. There is indeed meaning in one's life that exists. A treasure hunter wouldn't waste his time hunting and searching unless he had good reason to believe that there was actually a treasure that exists and that was to be found. And so when we think about this book, why was Solomon looking and searching for fulfillment and meaning? I think because there is meaning and there is purpose. And he was trying to find it in various ways. He was trying to find it out in certain specific ways. He just didn't know quite where to look for it. When we think about Ecclesiastes, Solomon's favorite word regarding everything is the word vanity, which simply means futile or fleeting or passing. What is the word vanity, as he uses it throughout this text, consistently used for, except that in all of his efforts and in all of his endeavors to find true meaning and true fulfillment in this life, he's finding everything to be pointless? He searched out what he was looking for, and he searched it out in a number of various ways, but at the end, he comes to this conclusion. He says, I considered all that my hands had done, the toil that I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity. A striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. What is Solomon saying? Solomon's saying, as I pursued all of these things in this life in an effort to try to find meaning and purpose and to try to accomplish things that I wanted to accomplish, but I never found it. As we get to the end of the book, we find why. And Solomon realizes why. He never found meaning, and he never found purpose, and he never found fulfillment because he was looking in all the wrong places. And then the book ends with, I finally figured it out. Fear God and keep His commandments. This is the whole duty of man. You know, as we think about and reflect on our own lives, we think about the things that Solomon pursued at the very beginning. We look at the beginning of the book of Ecclesiastes, and in chapter 2, and we're going to read this in just a moment, but in chapter 2, immediately, we start learning of Solomon's pursuits, Solomon's efforts that he's going to put forward into trying to find things that truly gave him joy, happiness, and pleasure. In the very beginning, in chapter 2 and verse 1, he says, I said in my heart, come now, and I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this was vanity. Before we continue reading this passage, let's just acknowledge just a few things that I think we would all agree to be very true. As we've experienced, we learn a lot of things from experience. And one of the things that I feel like we learn from experience is that no matter how much we acquire in this life, it's never going to be enough. No matter how far we go in this life, it's never going to be far enough. That seems to be just about the way it is with everything in this world. Earthly achievements never provide true joy, true happiness, true satisfaction, true fulfillment. Not only that, but we see and we experience and we observe that having more just leaves us wanting more. We buy a brand new car, the next year the newer, faster model comes out and we have to have it. Or we wish we had a better job, or we had more money, or wore nicer clothes, lived in a bigger house, had a good solid name that everybody knew, had this reputation of being a successful person. And we think sometimes that in our minds that these are the things that are going to fulfill us or make us complete. We think that these are the things that are going to meet our needs, that they are the things that are going to make us happy. But I think it's important as we observe what Solomon does in this text. Let's read beginning in chapter 2 and verse 1, and I'm going to read down through verse 11. In chapter 2 and verse 1, I said in my heart, "Come now, I will test you with pleasure, enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad and of pleasure. What use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom. And how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses. I planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers with men, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. So I became great, and I surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure. For my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was the reward for all of my toil." Let's stop there for just a second. We see this this Solomon, and he's seeking pleasure and joy and fulfillment and happiness, and he's saying, everything that I ever desired, everything that I ever wanted, the things that I dreamt about as a child, I'm going to seek those things out and I'm going to acquire them for myself, and then I'm going to be happy. I'm going to be truly satisfied. Now, as we just read down through that list, these were things that would have been personal to Solomon. I put myself in his shoes, and my list would look very different, and your list would look very different from mine. He's seeking out the gardens and the parks and things. I would probably seek out my story would probably read something. I said in my heart, "Come now, I'll test you with pleasure, enjoy yourself." And so I sought out hundreds of acres and a big log cabin with lots of horses everywhere. And the list would go on, and it would look very different from Solomon, and yours would look different from mine, and yours would look different from the person next to you. There are all things that we've probably thought about personally in our own life as we've grown up, that things that we would enjoy, things that we would like to have. But if we were to acquire everything that we ever sought out, I can assure you that the end of our story would be no different than Solomon's. Because Solomon, who we attribute the title, the wisest man that ever lived, at least as we go back into the Old Testament, or as we attribute to Solomon the reputation that he did have in his day. Even the Queen of Sheba, she came and she just stood in awe of all of the things that Solomon had. He was the richest man that lived. But yet in verse 11, "I considered all that my hands had done, the toil that I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity." striving after the wind, nothing to be gained under the sun. Did these things make Solomon happier? Did he find the answer to his problem? No, he didn't. As a matter of fact, as he sought fulfillment in everything under the sun, all he found out was that it was all in vain. Now, certainly God does bless us with physical things in this life, and this is not an effort to downplay that. I think God does bless us physically in this life. He blesses us with our jobs. He blesses us with our family. He blesses us with those who are close to us. He blesses us by giving us places to live and jobs to provide for ourselves and opportunities to get an education. All kinds of things God blesses us with, and we ought to be very thankful for that. God truly does bless His people in a very physical way, and we see that all the way back into the Old Testament, and the fact that one of the greatest blessings God gave to His people was entrance into the land, and provisions along the way, and provisions when they got there, in victory over God's enemies. And so when it comes to the things of this life, certainly we would all agree God never intends for us to put those things in the wrong perspective, and he intends for us to prioritize rightly. But the things that God blesses us with are good and well. But there's something that Solomon does have to say that we need never to forget. When it comes to the things of this life that we do put so much time and effort and energy into, to the extent that more often than not, it becomes a distraction to our spiritual lives and a hindrance. Solomon reminds us of something very important. In chapter 2, beginning in verse 18, let's notice very quickly what it says. Chapter 2, in verse 18, he says, "I hated all my toil in which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me." Okay, so Solomon already acknowledges that when it comes to the things that he has acquired to himself in an effort to gain pleasure, he says, it's just going to pass to somebody else. But he takes it a step further. Notice in the next verse, in verse 19, "And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity." Let me ask you a question. This stuff, all this things that we put our time and energy into, what happens when we die? Well, they pass to somebody else. They don't go with us, of course. But not only that, but Solomon says, and who knows, they may even pass to a fool who's going to throw away in a week what I spent my whole lifetime trying to acquire. All of these things that I toiled and stressed over and was anxious over, and all of this energy and time that I invested in these things passed to somebody else when I died, because you can't take it with you, and they just threw it all away. Everything that I've worked so hard for, he says, is going to go to someone who did not work for it, and in a moment of time, it could be gone. These things, he says, will not last. And it's almost as if he's saying, what a waste of a life. What a waste to invest so much time and energy, the majority of that, into things that just simply will not last. There is no glory in these things, he concludes. We need to not be fooled by our own passions and by our own pride. We need to be reminded of the fact that nobody comes to the conclusion that a man is a good man or a woman is a good woman by how much stuff he has, or how nice of a vehicle he has, or how nice of a house she has, or how easy they have it in their retirement, whatever it may be. Nobody, and I think this is universal, nobody comes to the conclusion that you are a good person based on those things. Successful, maybe, but that's a completely different story. Nobody comes to the conclusion that we are good people based on the things of this life. Yet how much time, energy, and money do we devote to those pursuits? In chapter 5, turn over just a couple of chapters. In chapter 5, we learn something about these pursuits that we are so heavily involved in. In chapter 5, beginning in verse 10, notice what he says. He says, Solomon says, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth will he be satisfied with his income, because this also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep." He who loves money will not be satisfied. Simply put, he's saying in these couple of verses, in verses 10 through 12, if we put our focus on earthly pursuits, these things will consume us. They will control us. We will be their slave, just like as we go into to the book of Romans in chapter 6, when we have this passage that's talking about really that's the description of the meaning of baptism and what it's meant to represent. Baptism is becoming like Christ. We, as He died, was buried, and resurrected, we too in the water go beneath the water and we died, we are buried, and as we come up, we are resurrected, given new life. Of course, the power is in the blood of Christ, but we humbly submit and obey and come to Him through faith, and we experience His grace. But anyways, thinking about that in Romans chapter 6 and what those things represent, he goes on to spend the rest of the chapter talking about from that point forward, our relationship with sin changes. And I think this is something we need to stress more when people obey the gospel, that Romans chapter 6 continues to say that no longer is my relationship with sin something that I can dabble in and out of, but it's something I've become dead to. That's why Paul later in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20 says, "I'm crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me." He says, "I've become dead to self and to the sin in which I once walked." My relationship with sin is that I have separated myself from it by the precious saving blood and grace of God, and I no longer walk with it. But he concludes in the middle of that chapter, he reminds us of something else that's very important for us to remember. Because in Romans chapter 6 and verse 15, he says, "Are we to sin because we are not under law but under grace? By no means." He says, do you not know that if you present yourselves to anyone as obedient slaves, you are slaves of the one whom you obey, either of sin which leads to death or of obedience which leads to righteousness? Did you know that when we sin, we have made ourselves slaves to sin? How is that possible? It's because we have allowed sin to master us. We have given in. We have relinquished control to evil. And the parallel to what we're talking about is that when we allow this world and the things of this world to control us and to guide us, and we give ourselves wholly to it, we become slaves. And we have relinquished control. Solomon says, having more money doesn't put you ahead in life. It's just what he says. Not getting that promotion isn't the end of the world. Young people, in regards to being popular in school, one day your eyes will be opened as mine eventually were. I wasn't popular in school, but I always wanted that. I think we all kind of in the back of our mind, just we have that feeling of wanting to be accepted by those around us and wanting to fit in with certain people. But one day we will have our eyes opened and we will look back and we'll realize that it didn't mean a thing.
And sadly, your perception will become so real to you, and you'll be able to see things truly as they are, to the extent that what you're going to find out is probably what I found out. It's sad that it's the case, but I look back on those that I went to school with who were in the popular crowd, and I see the pressures that they submitted to resulted in so many of them becoming the single parents and the drug and alcohol addicts of today. But we want so much because we look at everybody else who has it. We want to fit in and have all the cool things and see everybody else who has it and feel successful. But Solomon says in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, beginning in verse 4, he says, I saw all the toil and all the skill and work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. We can relate to that. It's exactly what we've been talking about. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. The fool holds his hands and eats his own flesh, but better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and a striving after the wind. What I take from this passage is that it's better to have little and worry about little than to be anxious, stressed, and exhaust oneself trying to achieve things that are in vain. When we think about Paul's attitude demonstrated in so many of his letters, we see an attitude of commitment. And it's interesting, you know, connecting back to our Bible class this morning, 2 Corinthians chapter 6, all of those things that Paul was willing to endure, the afflictions, the imprisonments, the beatings, the stonings, everything that took place. I think the simple answer as to how Paul was able to endure all of these things is because he had true joy in his heart for what God had done for him. He had true joy, and because of his joy, he was able to be content even when the situation in this life wasn't exactly what he would hope for it to be. In Philippians chapter 4 and verse 11, we see Paul saying this. He says, I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. That's a pretty powerful statement when you consider some of the places that Paul was. The Hebrew writer in Hebrews chapter 13 in verse 5. Hebrews chapter 13 in verse 5 makes a similar connection to contentment. In Hebrews 13 in verse 5, the Hebrew writer says, keep your life free from love of money. Be content with what you have. For he has said, I will never leave you or forsake you. You see what the Hebrew writer did there. He compared and he contrasted the things of this life and the presence and fellowship of God. Do you see kind of a connection between what the Hebrew writer was saying there? He says, do not free yourself from the love of money, for he has said, I will never leave you and forsake you. Doesn't it seem that he's implying that the things of this life, the love of money, they're all fleeting? Why would he contrast in the next statement, for I will never leave you or forsake you, without giving any kind of extra commentary on that? What he's saying is, free yourself from the love of money because these things are passing, but give yourself wholly to me because I will never pass from you. As a matter of fact, I will always be with you. What reason to boast? We have none. It's a simple answer. We have no reason to boast of self or of anything in this life, because all anything in this life has ever proved to be is just a glimpse of better things, fleeting glimpses of better things. There is nothing on this earth that is worthy of our boasting nor our trust except God alone. I want to get a little deeper and get a little bit go a little bit different direction now, because there's something else building on that foundation that I think is really important and powerful for us to understand and think about. As a matter of fact, I want to take this opportunity to depress you a little bit. I think it's kind of depressing sometimes for me to think about. One day, I'm going to give you a list of things here in just a minute, but there's just some simple foundational realities that Solomon touches on that I think we don't like to think about, but when we think about it, it dramatically influences our day-to-day living. The first one is this. One day, I will die. I just will. Unless the Lord comes first, I will die. It's a sure thing. It's inevitable. Something that we all face. I'm going to read to you very quickly three passages. I'm not going to take the time to turn to them, but Hebrews chapter 9 and verse 27, it says, "It is appointed for man to die once." In Ecclesiastes 3, verses 1 and 2, "Everything, there is a season, a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die." In the same chapter in verse 19 and 20, you're there in Ecclesiastes, you can actually flip over, you won't have to turn far, but in chapter 3 of Ecclesiastes 19 and 20, it says, "For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beast is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath. Man has no advantage over the beast, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from the dust, and to dust all return." That's pretty powerful, what Solomon is trying to do. It's almost like he's kind of giving us a slice of humble pie by saying that everyone's going to die. As a matter of fact, your fate, as far as physical life goes in this life, is no different than the beast of the field. Now, we don't like to think about that. But what he's trying to do is remind us that you share the same fate that I do, and I share the same fate of those who have passed on before me, that my body is going to go into the ground and is going to become as nothing. One day I will die. How much thought have you given to that? Maybe some of you have. Many of the younger ones may not have given as much thought about it. I think about it a lot. Sometimes, especially in the past, I don't so much anymore, but it's just questions. We just like to think about the things that we don't know and really can't know. When I think about my death, I ask questions. I wonder when it will happen. I wonder how it will happen. Probably more than anything, I worry, will I get bucked off the horse and hit my head or something? Maybe I'll be in an accident on the way home driving and get hit by a driver. Will I go in pain or will I go peacefully? So many questions that I have. You know how many answers that I've gotten for those questions? I've gotten none. And I stand pretty confident that I'll never have answers to those questions until it happens. So really, to think about it and to spend time worrying about it would be, in the eyes of Solomon, vanity, worthless, futile. But although I don't know how and I don't know when, I know that I will. James asked the question in James 4, verse 14, "What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little time and vanishes. You don't know what tomorrow will bring." And it's just a reminder that anything can happen to us at any given moment. I could just as easily as anybody else in this world die on my way home tonight. And as we go through the book of Ecclesiastes, one of the things that Solomon's going to stress time and time and time and time again is that time and chance, this is in chapter 9, verses 11 and 12, happen to everyone, regardless of whether you are man or beast. And let's be honest, he even acknowledges this, regardless of whether you're righteous or unrighteous. Time and chance happen to everybody. He even compares it to a fish that is taken up in an evil net, and birds that are caught in a snare. He says, "The children of man are snared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them." Reminder after reminder after reminder that, Jason Langford, one day you will die. And you will too. So you're probably asking the question, Jason, did you really bring us here to depress us with the thought of we're going to die? Actually, yes. But if you think you're depressed now, brace yourselves, because this next bit of truth from Solomon really hurts. If I were to ask you to raise, and we don't have to do it, if I were to ask you to raise your hand, if you know the name of your grandfather, most everybody's hand would go up. If I were to ask you if you knew the name of your great-grandfather, many hands would go up. Great-great-grandfather, not as many, but most still a lot of people would have their hands up. I've had people raise their hands for this before with this question regarding this, and the most that I've ever gotten is four generations where someone actually remembered just the name of a relative, four generations back. There may be someone here who could go a little bit further than that, but it wouldn't be much. What's the point? Look at chapter 1 and verse 4. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth, he says, remains forever. Look down in verse 11. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. Okay, so I die, and because we're friends, you're going to bring flowers, and you're going to put them at my grave. And you keep them there for a while, and for years, someone keeps the flowers at my gravesite refreshed, and new ones there all the time. But a generation comes and a generation goes. The earth remains forever. And in verse 11, he says, there is no remembrance of former things. What he's saying is that sooner or later, the flowers are going to stop. They're going to waste away. The name is going to fade on the tombstone. And four generations from now, maybe some of you five, if you can remember back, five generations from now, no one will even remember your name. That's depressing to think about, isn't it? Chapter 11, my version reads, there is no remembrance of former things. I think the NIV actually translates this more accurately. It says there is no remembrance of former people. As a matter of fact, if you're using a version other than that, you'll have a footnote there that'll refer you to the bottom or to the single column or something, and it'll have that written out, former people. A generation goes, a generation comes, verse 11, and they are forgotten. One day I will die. That day could be today. Time and chance happen to us all. And as generations come and generations go, the sad reality is that we will be forgotten. So far we've established I'm going to die and I'm going to be forgotten. What do we got next? Well, these are hard truths. But I think they are essential truths to teach us this lesson. If I'm going to be forgotten in this life, no matter what I do, no matter what I acquire, no matter what name I gain for myself, then why does it matter how popular I am? How big a house I have, what kind of car I drive, how many people like me. Why does it matter? Solomon's truth, it doesn't. Now let's just assume that those things did matter. Well, then the story would change a little bit, wouldn't it? If we were going to be remembered for the things like that, then sure, every day let's make more, let's go farther, let's upgrade everything. But it's just not that way. It's just not. I'm going to die. It could be any day. And eventually my name is even going to be forgotten. So now that we're depressed, let's think about the light at the end of the tunnel, because there is one, and Solomon actually does find that. I will be forgotten in this life. But praise God that He will remember me. There is, after all, someone who will remember me, and He won't just remember me, but He will be able to bring into account, because He has paid attention and He has watched me so intently, He'll be able to bring in account anything and absolutely everything about my life. Because I serve a God who knows so many things about me, even insignificant things like the number of hairs on my head. Now, who really cares how many hairs are on your head? I don't care to know the number, because it does nothing for me. But what that does is it just shows me how intense my God knows me. How personally my God knows me. And that's just amazing. God will remember me. And because He will remember me, though there are things in this life that striving for will not accomplish anything except vanity, because God will remember me, there are certain things that we can strive for and accomplish that are not in vain. We just said just a minute ago that if we were going to be remembered in this life, in this world, by the things that we did and acquired and the name, all that kind of stuff, that Solomon was seeking out, if we were going to be remembered by those things, then we would strive every day to make a deeper impression on the world. That just makes sense. It's just logical. But the point is this. If we won't be remembered for those things, therefore it's not logical to spend our time and energy and efforts into those things. What is logical is that if God is the only one who will remember, doesn't it make sense that we be striving every day to make a deeper impression on Him? Logically speaking, doesn't it make more sense to put time and effort and energy into the thing that will last forever, for all of eternity, that has no end, where there is no passing, there is no rust, thieves cannot break in, but it is eternal? An epitaph is a phrase or a statement written in memory of a person's life, usually on a tombstone. What would you want God to write on yours? If God was going to write and inscribe a message on your tombstone, what would you want God to write? Maybe a question that might even make us think even more. If God was to consider my life as I'm living it right now, what would He write? I think as we examine ourselves, it might not be really what we would want. Because I feel pretty confident that what we would want is an epitaph or a description given, like maybe was given to David. David was a man after God's own heart. That's amazing, isn't it? For God Almighty to say that at the summation of your life, He was a man after my own heart. Or another one that I like, it was of Joshua and Caleb, and specifically of Caleb. Of Caleb, God says, he wholly followed the Lord. Holy, not H-O-L-Y, but W-H-O-L-L-Y. He completely and absolutely followed the Lord. That's pretty amazing. They devoted their lives to the Lord, and the Lord blessed them richly for it. 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 58 says, 1 Corinthians 15 and 58 says, therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. Light at the end of the tunnel, there is a work that is not in vain. There is something that we can do in this life and feel a sense of accomplishment and success. The only thing is we have to train ourselves to remember that it's not going to look like the same image that the world has of success and accomplishment. It's not going to look the same. But it's the only one that will last, be eternal. There is a work, there is indeed a work that is not in vain, and you're not wasting your time, and it does accomplish something. It is something that will not perish. It is the work of the Lord. The psalmist in Psalm 127 in verse 1 says, "Unless the Lord builds the house, those who labor build it in vain." What God wants is He wants to be at the center. He wants us to work diligently, being driven by Him first and foremost in absolutely everything that we do. Because the world's ways, they are not our ways. They are perishable. They are meaningless. Our way is the way that reaps eternal benefits. In 1 John 2, 15 through 17, 1 John 2, 15 through 17, as we start drawing this to a close, in chapter 2, in verse 15, it says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and the pride of life, they're not from the Father, but they are from the world. And the world is passing away along with its desires. But whoever does the will of God abides forever." What is he saying? He's saying this is the labor that's not in vain. You want meaning, you want purpose in the things that you're doing in this life. Focus on the spiritual things. Focus on God. And He will give you purpose, meaning, fulfillment, and success. Colossians 3:17, "Whatever you do in word or deed, do everything in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through Him." Why? Because God will remember. Because God is everlasting, because God cares, because God is awesome. He is the Alpha, the Omega, the beginning, and the end. And in this alone, we find life's meaning. Focus on the Lord. Unless the Lord comes first, as we sum up, death is going to come to us. In this world, you will be forgotten, but God, He's going to remember. So our purpose is to live every day making an impression on Him. Paul asked the questions to the Galatians in response to learning that some of them had turned to a different teaching in Galatians 1:10. He says, "For now, am I seeking the approval of man or of God? Am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." It's a shift of masters. It's a transition that takes place. Who is it that we will focus on? Solomon concludes in chapter 12, the passage we're all familiar with, verse 13 and 14. "The end of the matter is this, all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil." We have this constant search for meaning and for purpose and for fulfillment and for success. And the beauty is that true success can be found. But we have to learn from Solomon and from our own experiences and acknowledge that sometimes we just look in the wrong places. But if we will put our focus and our concentration in God, He will give us every measure of success that we will ever hope to have. And of course, with success, we can own this face of accomplishment. Perfect. If you're here this morning, this evening, and you haven't given your life to Christ yet, then the message tonight holds true for you just as well as anybody. We will all leave this life at some point. And God will remember you.
And he'll either remember you in a favorable light or an unfavorable light. Now let's be clear, even if that light is favorable, we still require his grace. But it still doesn't change the fact that he gives us purpose, meaning, and allows us to accomplish that through him. But let me stress that it is only through him. And if you are here tonight and you have yet to give yourself to him, then you have the greatest need. Anything you'll ever need in your life, this will trump it. The salvation of your soul is only accessed by Jesus Christ, the Son of God. But if you will give yourself to him, he promises to make you clean, pure, to bring you into the presence of God, and to guard you and to walk with you if you so choose for the rest of your life. And at the end of the way, if found faithful, he will bring you safely into that eternal abode, where, as Revelation 21 reminds us, we will forever be with him, and he will be our God, and we will be his people. If you're subject in any way, please come as we stand and sing.